you very much, and thank you very much for everybody to come and pack yourselves into this rather small room. I know you've been asked not to leave, but if you do at any point need to stand up and stretch your legs, please do feel free to do that. I won't at all be offended. And just to echo what Morgan said, we're going to present work which is very much work in progress, and questions really are very welcome from each and every one of you, so please don't hold back with the questions. So the way we're going to do this, I think, is that I'll present the paper, and Tadisa and myself will then, I guess, split the questions. He'll take the difficult ones and I'll take the others. So this is a joint project that we started a few years ago. As Chris said, my primary field work is in lowland South America. I found myself, for various reasons, going to Ethiopia rather regularly, and I thought I should turn that into a sort of secondary field site. There are connections, I hope, at least in my mind, between some of the work I did in, or still do, I suppose, in Brazil, on gardening and people's relationships to their garden products, and the work we're doing here in Ethiopia. So for Tadisa, I think it's fair to say this is field work at home. We work and stay in a place which is Tadisa's home place. And for me, it's kind of doubly field work in a strange place, because it's both strange to me from my own background, but it's also strange to me coming from the Amazon. But one of the things that I see from this very much is that comparative anthropology of old is a really fun anthropology to do, and the ideas and questions that came out of some of the work in the Amazon are ideas and questions that I think have been helpful in thinking about the current project. Now, the Gamo people in the highlands of southern Ethiopia are forever telling us, inset is what sustains us. This paper and the book that we're writing is our attempt to map out what that might imply for people, for their land, and for their crops. And this paper is really about that. What does it mean to say inset is what sustains us? Now, this week I've been working with my students on Malinowski, so I thought it would be fair to go back to Malinowski to start the paper. Now, in his monumental treatise on gardens and gardening magic in the Trobriands, Malinowski observes the following, and this is a quote. Among other apparently extrinsic elements, we find surprising care for the aesthetics of gardening. The gardens of the community are not merely a means to food, they're a source of pride and the main object of collective ambition. Care is lavished upon effects of beauty, pleasing to the eye and the heart of the Trobrianer, upon the finish of the work, the perfection of various contrivances, and the show of food. In this paper, we want to explore the garden making, growing, and food processing connected to inset, a staple crop which is domesticated in a number of places in the southern and southwestern highlands of Ethiopia. Inset, also known in English as Abyssinian banana, and more unfortunately as false banana, has in the past two decades received some attention, beyond, of course, its growers who've been paying attention to it for a very long time, some attention from agroecologists due to its apparent resilience to drought and the storability of some of the food products derived from it. It's also been noted by Tadisa Kipe, by Stephen Brandt and others, that inset forms a key food resource in areas of high population density, with estimates ranging from 10 to 15 million people in Ethiopia living off inset, or relying on inset for their food. Various sources in the literature further suggest that inset agriculture can sustain population densities of around 400 individuals per square kilometer, rising even in some cases above that, up to 500 individuals. So very high population densities that are sustained by inset agriculture. Now, any visitor to the southern highlands of Ethiopia will be struck by the apparent ubiquity of what at first glance looks strikingly like banana trees. Technically speaking, inset is in fact not a tree at all, but rather a vegetable or herb, albeit one that can grow up to 10 meters tall. Inset, known in Gamo as uts, cluster around homesteads and are found in dense groups dotted across the richly cultivated landscape that characterizes the Gamo Highlands. And on here, everything that looks sort of silvery green, these areas here, up there, around there, are clusters of inset. Now, indeed, inset provides visual continuity as the visitor's eye moves from an appreciation of the rural landscapes to views of highland towns and settlements, since urban homesteads too are characterized by tall, dense groves of inset behind the residential house. And this is a view of Chincha town with the same clustering of inset behind people's houses. While inset has a long history of cultivation in this part of Ethiopia, the particularity of the crop has more recently been picked up as a symbol for regional political identities. Thus, a giant model of a spiraling stem of inset was erected some years ago as a symbol of the Sidamo people and that of the southern nations, nationalities and peoples on a busy roundabout in the state capital of Awassa. It's a roundabout, it's a stylized spiral of inset which grows indeed in a kind of spiral shape. It also features as the symbol of one of the Gamo regional political parties of the early 1990s. In this sense, today, inset has become something of a political symbol to urban political elites who have themselves, in most cases, ceased cultivating inset, and who themselves may well view inset as food product, as something that rural people eat and poor people eat. Now, research to date on inset in Ethiopia centers mainly around questions of productivity, disease resistance, and genetic diversity in the context of food security issues. So much of the research is driven by questions of how to improve inset yield and what role inset could play in enabling food security. It might seem tempting then to focus solely on the role of inset in buffering against hunger in the highlands, exploring how specific properties of the plant and its products give it a resilience and a durability that allow it to play a key role in preventing famine. Indeed, this is what Stephen Brandt and his fellow authors set out to do in their report on inset entitled The Tree Against Hunger, a turn of phrase, by the way, which goes back to the 17th century traveler to Ethiopia who identified inset as the tree against hunger. Now here they show very clearly how inset cultivation should be taken seriously by aid organizations and those involved in devising famine prevention policies. And furthermore, that the successful cultivation of inset might provide a reliable and resilient form of food security in the region. Similarly, a recent short article in Newsweek assesses the potential role inset could play in lifting African farmers out of poverty, by focusing on the productive potential of inset, as well as the storability of inset products. Brandt and others see inset as, above all, important in terms of food security in a context in which food production is understood always to be precarious. Now, while we don't want to minimize the extent to which providing enough food to feed a population is, of course, an important concern, we would also suggest, though this paper will not directly deal with these issues here, that causes for poverty and hunger need to be situated within a broader political picture that includes questions of land tenure on a national and often international scale, as well as questions regarding the role of agricultural extension work and the consequences of seed and fertilizer distribution. Against the certainty that things could always be better, crops could always yield more, and farming knowledge could always be improved, we ask ourselves, what is it that farmers know and do? What connections have sustained them today? And what values underpin the arts of living in the Gamo Highlands? This, what we want to do in our work is to show how inset can be understood as a keystone within a wider cultural ecology involving animals, food, ritual life, aesthetics, and land tenure. More specifically, relations to bamboo, to cattle, and the soil, the earth, stand out as particularly salient. Now, the notion of keystone species appears suggestive. The concept's been developed in the field of ecology, where it's been of some significance in debates on conservation. According to ecologists, keystone species, a term coined by Robert Payne in 1969, are species whose presence is crucial in maintaining the order and diversity of a particular ecology. In short, if a keystone species disappears, there are far-reaching knock-on effects for other species too. More recently, social scientists have sought to draw on the concept to develop the idea of cultural keystone species, which would be species that are salient and crucial to specific cultural identities. According to Gary Balbi and Turner, quote, cultural keystone species are culturally salient species that shape in a major way the cultural identity of a people. Their importance is reflected in the fundamental role these species play in diet, in materials, medicine, and or spiritual practices. And we could add here, of course, also the role played by NSET in regional and national politics, as well as increasingly in the wider Ethiopian economy. Malinowski, too, drew attention to interconnectedness in analyzing gardening practices when he wrote, "The sociology of garden making is intricate. Parts played by the chief or headman of the community, by the official garden magician, by the owners of the soil, by those who lease the garden plots, by those who benefit from the harvest, dovetail and intertwine into a complex economic and social network which constitutes the land tenure of these natives." End quote. But while Malinowski focused on human social relations and institutions by drawing attention to the interconnections between politics, kinship, property relations, economics, and ritual, we want here to draw attention to the interconnection between plants, people, animals, and land. As the book will show, and we hope to discuss more briefly in this paper, a web of relationships exist between varieties of inset, soil types, pastures, types of grasses, trees, and other crops. Spirits and humans, as well as visible and non-visible life under the soil, contribute to the mutual nourishment, reproduction, and growth. In his book, The Botany of Desire, Michael Pollan illustrates how humans' desire for sweetness, for beauty, intoxication, and control shaped the coevolution of humans and certain crops such as apples and potatoes. Noting that plant genes are rich archives of cultural as well as natural information, he argues that these crops succeeded by attracting human attention and desire through improving their taste, appearance, nutrition, and addictive quality, while humans honed their own capacity to select, to breed, and improve these crops over time. Well, it's a good time to be studying social anthropology. I say that to all the new students who've joined us this year. Given that the discipline, such as disciplines such as biology, seem now to be ever more interested in relations between species, such relations are increasingly understood to be generative rather than merely connective, as Anat Singh has recently shown. In turn, the interest in interspecies relations moves anthropology beyond the tendency to place human beings at the center of the social and allows for the possibility that people become just one kind of actor in a web of multiple agents who together make the world. Or as Singh put it in her recent book on the world-making capacities of Mazzataki mushrooms, first, rather than limit our analyses to one creature at a time, including humans, or even one relationship, if we want to know what makes places livable, we should be studying polyphonic assemblages, gatherings of ways of being. Assemblages are performances of livability. These ideas push us to look beyond keystone species within cultural ecology in highlighting the importance of webs of relations. Here we find that Donna Haraway's recent discussion of sympoiesis brings us closer to what we see going on with inset, humans, animals, and earths. So what's going on with insect, with humans, with animals, and with the earth? As she puts it, symphoresis is a simple word. Doesn't appear so at first, does it? It means making with. Nothing makes itself. Nothing is really autopoetic or self-organizing. To push this further then would be to blur the boundaries between species and to emphasize the mutual world-making, or worlding, as Haraway terms it, that goes on in interspecies encounters. As we hope to demonstrate in this paper and more fully in the book, insect can be understood then as an important entity within a wider cultural ecology, incorporating animal husbandry, food, houses and compounds, other crops and trees, aesthetics, as well as ritual and economic relations. In addition, processes of cultivation and growth involving farmers and insect manure, crops such as barley, bamboo, different kinds of soil, may also be understood as processes of mutual making. Now, first, I think we want to move now to give a brief introduction to the region in which we work and to the crop inset itself. So that was the kind of backstory, now the ethnography. Right, inset is cultivated across the southern and southwestern highlands of Ethiopia. And while Ethiopia is the only place where inset has been domesticated, it does grow wild across wide areas of Africa, including Tanzania, Uganda, Mozambique, Congo, Zambia, and as far west, I believe, as Cameroon. Interestingly enough, reports by the traveller James Bruce from the 1770s attest to the presence of domesticated inset also in the northern parts of Ethiopia, the northern highlands of Ethiopia. But it seems to have completely disappeared from that area. Now, why that might be seems a little bit unclear, but it might be connected to histories of conquest, as well as political and economic developments that encouraged grain cultivation over tuber crops. Right, the next section is about the Gamma Highlands. So the area we talk about here is located on the western escarpment of the African Rift Valley in southwestern Ethiopia, and is known as the Gamma Highlands, and it's roughly that green blob there. Now, the Gamma Highlands extend north-south along the western shores of the two Rift Valley lakes, Abaya and Chamor, in blue there, with the Omo River Valley marking their western limit. The Gamo people, speakers of Gamotso, also referred sometimes to as Dutch Itso, and is a nomotic language. And the Gamo people live in this mountainous territory characterized by extensive pastures, rivers, and streams. There are about 50 sections of Gamo, and these 50 sections in turn are made up out of over 60 clans. And those clans cross-cut the sections. You've got the sections, and you've got roughly around 60 clans that cross-cut the various Gamo sections. And the clans, in fact, spread out beyond the Gamo into various neighboring peoples as well. Until their ban in 1974, each section of Gamo was ruled by a kaol, a political and spiritual chief who provided the communities with leadership. Traditional governance structures continue to play a significant role in local life today, including the management of resources such as pastures and paths that connect communities, the maintenance of order in marketplaces, and the management of relations between communities, as well as the organization of labor in agriculture and communal rituals and celebrations. At present, older Gamo structures of governance coexist more or less easily alongside more recent state governance structures. Now, in the highlands, inset is cultivated as part of a mixed system of agriculture in which cereal crops, notably barley, certain wheat varieties, and tubers such as yams, potatoes, and potatoes are grown and consumed alongside peas, tree cabbage, broad beans, and more recently, beetroot, carrots, and apples. Now, in many ways, we might say that Gamo society is hierarchical, and this includes both stratification of human social groups as well as
stratification of trees and crops, the organization of trees into relations of seniority, crops into relations of seniority. So the more than 60 clans of the Gamo are understood to stand in hierarchical relation to one another. And hierarchy is equally important at the level of lineages and families. The relations of seniority within a family or lineage and among clans is further mirrored by a hierarchy of crops. Barley, for example, is widely viewed as senior to all crops, with inset being next in the hierarchy. Although there's some dispute about that. Some people say inset's more senior to barley. Bamboo, in turn, is considered to be senior amongst trees, preceded by a flowering tree known as lolashe, which plays an important role in a key annual ritual known as maskal. So bamboo is nearly at the top of the hierarchy of trees. There are many varieties of inset with distinct qualities, some of which are about taste, while others are about specific medicinal qualities, roles in sacrifice, or the suitability for preparation of specific dishes. Lots of different varieties of inset, lots of different purposes for which you use inset. Now, a recent study on inset diversity in 12 Gamo communities identified something around 139 named varieties, with about between 17 and 66 varieties in different each community. In our own area of study, we found roughly around 20 varieties that people were cultivating. As Ante, a Gamo farmer, told us, he said, "Inset is like humans. We can't count and finish the number of clans of humans. Humans are many, and so are the clans of inset." Also, according to Ante, just like the political and spiritual chiefs known as kaos that used to lead the Gamo sections, so inset too has a kao, which he identified as the Genna variety, particular variety of inset. Thus, relations of seniority also apply to inset varieties, just as they do to the Gamo clans. Just like humans too, all inset varieties are identified as being either male or female. Importantly though, being female or male in the world of inset has nothing to do with reproductive aspects of inset, but instead refers to particular material and sensory qualities, as well as playing a role in determining the spatial location of the maturing inset plants, as I'm going to show you in a moment. So you've got male varieties of inset and female varieties of inset, and they've got nothing to do with the reproduction of the plant. You don't need male and female to reproduce. In tracing the parallels between the social organization of people and that of inset, one clear difference emerges, which relates, as I mentioned, to reproduction. For while women and men complement one another in the reproduction of humans, domesticated inset, according to Gamo farmers, has lost the ability to reproduce without assistance. It's not only that male and female varieties of inset have absolutely nothing to do with reproduction, but rather domesticated inset relies entirely on its humans in order to reproduce. If inset then is said to sustain people, as we were so often told, then Gamo farmers' insistence on their essential role in the reproduction of inset suggests strongly that, from the inset's point of view, to borrow an Amazonian turn of phrase, humans are what sustain inset. We therefore now turn to a brief account of inset cultivation and a little bit about the processing of the plant. Now, inset then is reproduced vegetatively by a process of cloning, which is triggered by human intervention. However, before that can happen, the ground needs to be prepared, which frequently involves farmers calling upon their labor groups to help them. Now, both male and female household heads are normally part of labor groups. We don't really have time to go into it, but there's a kind of complex system of different kinds of labor groups for different types of people and different types of purposes. Anyway, so the preparation of the ground involves men digging the ground knee-deep in a process known as hoto. And this is done using a double-pronged hoe known as a tsoile, which is a ubiquitous tool of of Highland agriculture. Meanwhile, women are in charge of bringing and distributing manure, carried either in baskets or on their backs, or loaded onto pack horses and mules. In urban settings, the preparation of the ground for planting inset is often the responsibility of paid labourers who work the plot of one or several townspeople. Now, once the ground is ready, the lower part of the pseudostem and corm of a carefully selected inset plant is split in half lengthways. Okay, so what you have on your left is rough, maybe about 3 or perhaps 4 year old inset that's been selected. It's been cracked open, and the heart is then carefully removed with a small knife. The heart, which is in Damo Unkulo, is carefully removed using a small knife. And the edges, so you pulled out the heart there, and then what you do is you scratch the edge of that area that from which you've removed the heart. You scratch that with a knife. And that piece of inset is then buried about 30 centimeters deep in this ground, which has been hotted with the tzoile. It's buried in there with a bunch of manure around it. About 3 months later, the new suckers are going to appear above ground, sprouting from the rim of the cracked inset. And it's going to be around 80 to 100, some farmers say 150 suckers that pop up out of the ground there. Now, this first stage of inset propagation is known as hatso. And the new suckers, so these little suckers, can then normally be seen close to the house. They get planted. So there's all the little baby inset suckers who've come sprouting out of the ground. And they're called hatso, carefully tended close to the house. And they're kept well out of reach of cattle. Keep them out of reach of your chickens, because they would certainly finish off all those tender little shoots. Now, the evening after burying the hats, or the evening after burying the mother corm, families are supposed to gather together around a pot of cooked inset. And while they place their hands above the food, they say, "Oya, oya," which is a term of blessing that can be translated as "be plenty" or "be the future." And it's used exclusively for blessing buried inset prior to sprouting. Some people, instead of saying "oya oya," and say "waza waza," and that translates as "be mature, grow up." Now, there are 4 stages to inset cultivation, starting with hertzel, which is the first stage, from initial burial of the mother corm through to about 12 months later, about a year later, when the densely clustered shoots of the hertzel are gently dug up and they're separated out, pulled apart, and then replanted slightly further apart from one another, again following the same knee-deep digging with the double-pronged hoe tzoile. This second stage is known as male. And the male stay there, and they stay there for about a year. And after about a year, you do the same thing again. You dig them up and you replant them. Okay, replant them now at greater distance from one another. They're now known as chero. So they sit in their chero, and what you have here is a picture of, you've got the house, you've got in one corner, in one area, you've got the hatso, you've got the little male plants, and then you've got the bigger generations of inset. I should say it takes about 7 years for inset to reach maturity in this part of Ethiopia. It depends a little bit on altitude. A little bit further down, it matures a little bit more quickly. So what you've got here essentially is probably roughly 7 generations of inset, so annual planting and then the annual transplanting and replanting of inset. Now, so the chero now, they can be kept where they've been planted, out in the field, further away from the home, closer to the home. They can be kept there and they can be eaten. They can be eaten really from any time onwards, from 3 to 4 years onwards, all the way to maturity. You can dig them up and you can eat them. But for some inset, their journey doesn't stop there. Some inset, male inset plants, they can be transplanted once more. So once more, they can be dug up and they can be carried, and they get carried to an area behind the residential house, which is known as the ala. Now, the ala you can see here behind the bamboo fence there, right? Now, in the ala, what you want is you always want to have high, nearly mature or completely mature inset there, and it should always be surrounding your house. Okay, not all of the inset can fit into the ala, but certain ones are selected and they're brought there. And they're left there and they grow until maturity, and maturity is the production of a single flower, fruiting thing, and then you harvest. Okay. Now, so the ala refers to this area behind the residential house, which is always planted with tall maturing inset. As the inset in the chero starts to grow bigger, selected plants are dug up and they're brought to the ala, where narrow channels of manure lead from the rear of the house out into the garden. And the manure is considered to be crucial to ensuring the really big, stocky growth of your ala inset. Okay. Now, they carry the manure, these channels carry the manure from sheep, from cattle, who spend the night in the compound alongside people. So typically, animals sleep on one side of the house and people sleep on the other side of the house. But if you've got lots of animals, you might make a dedicated barn for them. And at the back of the barn, or the back of the area where the animals stay, you've got an opening in the house, and out of there, you can channel the manure out into the ala. Now, in this way then, animals who are sustained in part by feeding on the green leaves of insect, because indeed the green leaves, that foliage of insect, can be used and is fed as a kind of dinner time when animals come back in from the fields, you feed them on the green leaves of insect. In turn, the animals sustain the insect as well as other crops with their dung. And the manure of animals is not just manure, it's not just the excrement of animals, but rather you mix it, you get the leaves of particular trees that from out in the field, coso trees, you gather the leaves and you mix those down, you put a bedding for the animals and you mix the manure with the coso leaves to prepare a really nutritious dung for the plants. And insect in particular is said to really like this kind of dung. Now, over the first 4 years of its life, insect then could be transplanted up to 4 times. Finding the right spot for a particular insect plant requires you to find land that will like the insect. Because according to farmers, not all land likes all inset varieties. Now, one farmer listing the varieties of inset he cultivates noted the following. There are people who've got less types than I have, and others who have more. I'll just take the kinds that my land likes to have. In another instance, a farmer had planted a particular variety in one part of his ala, but he found that the land, in his own words, there did not like the variety. So he dug it up, transplanted it to another area where it subsequently flourished. So planting and raising, successfully raising inset, is also about working out what your land likes. And we don't have time to go into it here, but it's worth noting that Gamo farmers distinguish a very high number of different soil varieties. And they say of their land that you can never say of land that it's not productive. There is always something that the land will like. It's only caves and cliffs that are understood to be, as it were, non-productive. Everything else, you can find something that the land will like. But importantly, it's about the land's pleasure, as it were, as opposed to the plant's pleasure. Okay? If the land likes it, the plant will be tolerated. Now, while animal manure is considered essential to the successful cultivation of inset, as I mentioned, also provides nourishment to animals. Because selected leaves from ala inset, and indeed from the chero, from out in the fields, are regularly cut and chopped up as animal fodder to supplement the grass that the animals feed on during the day. In turn, fed well on inset and on grass, animals will provide dung, which mixed with the leaves of the coso tree will provide nourishment not just to the inset, but of course also to barley and wheat fields too. As the inset grows, farmers, both men and women, develop close and tactile relations with their plants. As a farmer walks through her grove, she'll run her hands along the trunks of her inset. She'll adjust or tie up drooping leaves. She'll remove dried outer leaf sheets that she might later use to wrap inset products and other foodstuffs, such as butter. One of the things that normal farmers mention when they talk about inset is the fact that there is absolutely nothing about the plant that doesn't get used in one way or another. If you don't eat it, you're going to make rope from it. If you don't make rope, you're going to use it to wrap things. If you don't use it to wrap things, you're going to feed it to your animals, and so on. Nothing, they say, is wasted. Out in the one-year-old Malle and in the older Cero stages, a farmer will similarly spend time crouching among his or her plants, pulling up unwanted weeds, tying up inset leaves to form a straight kind of tall cylinder, which is said to promote plant growth and make the plant grow tall and strong. This tactile relation to inset is mirrored by close and tactile relations to a farmer's animals, and particularly to the cattle. In the Gamo Highlands, it's cold up there. It's about 2,700 meters up, a little bit higher still. So in the Gamo Highlands, animals are brought in every evening. They come in before sunset, and then they stay inside in the house until around about 10:30, sometimes even 11 in the morning, when the dew on the grass has dried. At that time, they're allowed out, but before they go off to graze, a farmer will run his hands along the bodies of the cattle, smoothing their coats, and then pull the tail of the animal to make the spine lengthen and to elongate, and causes it to kind of click after the night that they've spent kind of in close confinement inside the house. So fundamental is manure to the growth of inset that one of the main limitations to the size of a farmer's inset fields is the limit on farm animals that can be supported. Here, common pasture land, collective pasture land, grazing land, plays an important role because it provides an important source of grazing to sustain animals. A pasture that is closed to animals to allow the grass to regenerate is marked by a ceremonial leader who plants a single bamboo pole into the ground. So you plant this bamboo pole, then the pasture is closed. After a while, you're going to pull up the bamboo and the pasture is open for collective grazing. In recent years, though, there have been attempts to plow common pasture land, because pasture land, to the eyes of the state agricultural extension workers, looks like non-productive land. Like you could be growing something there, but just leave it doing nothing, as it were. Now, from the point of view then of agricultural extension workers, common grazing land looks as though it's unproductive and it ought to be planted, preferably with recognizable cash crops. Now, the appropriation of common pasture land for cash crop cultivation and for other purposes in turn imposes limitations on how many animals a farmer can sustain. Competing claims to land from urban municipalities and local farmers result in farmers building compounds on what would have once been pasture land in order to show the town that the land is being used. So if the town limits expand outwards, farmers are increasingly building their houses on close to the borders to show that they're occupying that land, that land is productive. There's a kind of competition there over land, and it hinges on this idea of what constitutes productive land. Another case would be a recent case of the late Gashtana, who was a farmer who died without any heirs. There's nobody to inherit. Now, under ordinary circumstances, his land would have fallen to the local neighborhood, and they would have used it to collectively graze animals. Fearing, however, that the land would be appropriated by the town, the elders in this case decided to divide up that land into individual plots and share these amongst neighbors, and who would then plow strips of it so that it would appear to be productive land, land that was being planted. All this really just to say that the politics around land and relations between urban and rural areas, as they shift, grazing animals are missing out, which in turn has knock-on implications for the sustenance of insect that expects regularly to be fed with manure. For while insect depends on humans to ensure reproduction and transplantation over many years, it really depends on animals for its ongoing food supply. Through their manure, animals provide important nutrients to the insect, and increasing the amount of manure channeled to the plants can dramatically increase the growth and maturation of insect. Now, there's no time here to explore it further, but we should note here that there are contributions also from other crops, certain trees in particular, that contribute to the feeding of insect and indeed to the feeding of animals. When people in Gamo say insect is what sustains us then, they do not simply refer to the nutritional value of insect for their own diets, but rather also to the way in which insect forms an important part of a wider web of interdependencies between land, plants, animals and humans. Okay, so the next bit is about the processing and harvesting of insect. So moving away from the care and labour that goes into growing, we look at the labour that goes into harvesting. Now, shukite, slaughter it, Wogase said, as she and her friend Mulo and Wogase's husband Gata harvested a mature, maybe 7 to 8 meter tall insect plant. It was a really long job to get the plant out of the ground, and it involved several rounds of carefully cutting into and peeling off layers of the plant, laying these on a bed of leaves, cutting and stripping and finally chopping off what remained of the inner stem. Okay, so this is the process of harvesting, and insect, like a banana, grows in these kind of layers, so you have a process, it's a bit like unpeeling an onion. And it's in fact a job which it looks like you're sort of just doing it here, but in fact the amount of discussion that went into where to place the cut and what to pull off next was impressive. Okay, so you've peeled away all you can and you've cut off the top, and now the really tough job starts of digging up the corm. So you've got the top, the sort of pseudostem, and then underground you've got a corm which can, in this case it was about this big, but it can be up to 1 meter tall underground, an underground corm which needs to be dug up. The earth is holding on with its teeth. It really likes this insect. That's what Wogase was saying as she dug away and heaved at the corm and the lower stem. Earlier, Gata had pointed out that this particular insect had come to a really good agreement with the water in the ala, evidenced, he said, by the way the corm had grown down into the ground rather than staying on top on the surface above ground. Shukite, slaughter it! Repeatedly, Gata and his wife explained that harvesting a mature insect is for women what for men is the slaughter of an ox. And indeed, slaughtering a mature insect is precisely what you do in the run-up to the annual Mascal celebrations, when families will join together to buy and slaughter an ox before feasting on its meat together with insect. Slaughtering an ox involves a lot of strength as men wrestle the bull, or the ox rather, to the ground before cutting its throat. And as it falls, as the ox falls before being slaughtered, it comes to rest on a bed of leaves, including a particular herb known as shash in Gamo, which is used for such occasions. When insect is wrestled out of the ground, it too ultimately comes to rest on a bed of leaves, which comprehensively separates it from the soil that had held onto it so tightly. And among the leaves that the insect rests on, the same herb that makes the bed for the bull at slaughter. And just as a slaughtered ox is then carefully butchered, so too the layers of insect pseudostem are carefully cut and stripped away, laid on a bed of leaves, ready to then be scraped in the next step of processing. Now, the comb, this is the comb here, is bit by bit scraped using a bamboo tool, which is essentially a section of bamboo with a rectangular piece removed, leaving a sharp edge with which you kind of scrape thin layers off the comb. This is a sort of rectangle, you can see it here, this kind of long piece of bamboo. You've cut out a little bit and that leaves a kind of sharp edge, and it looks a little bit like this. Now, so the comb gets scraped, but scraping is also what you do with the pseudostem, which is equally done in the ala where the thing was harvested, and you take each section of that thing that was peeled away, of the pseudostem which was peeled away, and you tie it up against the board like this, and then the same process takes place. You scrape away the pulp. On the ground, and then a load of fiber which you hang up to dry, and that's then what you make rope from. You can also make sacks from it and a whole load of other things too. Now that pulpy fiber is then left to settle, and it produces a very fine white starch. You squeeze it out and let the juice settle, and produces a fine starch which is known as itima, which is one of the most highly valued enset products. The rest of the kind of pulp there, you also use. You bury that in a pit out there, right out there in the ala. You line the pit with enset leaves, and you bury the pulp there, and you allow it to ferment. And there it ferments over a period of weeks. Every week or so, you open it up and knead it and turn it over. And it can then be kept there for several months. As it increasingly, I suppose, ferments and can be then turned into all kinds of different foods that we don't really have time to go into here. The leftover fibers, as I mentioned, can be then used to make ropes, sacks, you can make hats, you can make baskets. There's all kinds of things you can do with it. Now, to eat enset on its own, however, is considered to be highly undesirable. So here too, interdependence between enset and other crops and animals is emphasized. In the words of one elder, Halakagomba, if you were to eat enset on its own, the throat would not let it pass. Instead, cooked enset prepared in a variety of ways should be preferentially eaten with butter or with a sauce of sour, spicy milk, preferably mixed with tree cabbage, with potatoes, with beans, with garlic and other foods. And indeed, enset should ideally be consumed alongside a whole host of other foodstuffs, including barley porridge, pulses, beans and so on. So in fact, we did a bit of a survey over a week of 10 different households, so five in town and five in rural areas. And it's in fact the case that people don't, on the whole, eat enset on a daily basis, more so in the rural areas than in the towns. But enset forms part of a diet that draws on a whole load of different crops. And I mention that because there's been some research on enset that suggests that it might not be terribly nutritionally valuable. But from the point of view of Gamo people, the whole point is that you don't eat it on its own. Shouldn't eat it on its own. Now, nonetheless, despite not eating it every day, a number of our interlocutors would say things like, "Inset is what sustains us," or "It's hard enough to get by as things stand. Where would we be without inset?" And they cite moments where other crops have failed and inset has carried them through. And woman farmer Aznaku Aye observed the following: "Enset after God is the most important thing. NSAID is the top, the king of crops, but unfortunately it spends the night outside the house. It deserves to be treated respectfully inside the house, but because of its size, it remains outside. All the other crops after harvest come inside. It, NSAID, solves more problems than all the other crops, but unfortunately it stays outside. On the other hand, in the hierarchy of crops, barley is also sometimes named as the most senior of crops, followed by wheat, and only then by NSAID. A man, and there may well be a gendered aspect to this, told us that NSAID is a lesser crop. You won't be hungry having NSAID, but it doesn't heat your body. If you feel cold and have a small amount of barley, that will really rest in your stomach. It strengthens your body and you can jump. So this idea that NSAID is the king of crops is something that's a little bit contested as well. Right. I'm going to skip ahead to the conclusion. Now, so far, we've described the ways in which NSAID is grown and processed and have emphasized interdependence and mutual symphoresis, making together, that goes on between animals and NSAID, each one sustaining the other, as well as the close relations that people develop with their NSAID and with their animals. There's also a whole kind of aesthetic aspect to this, which we haven't had time to talk about today, but which forms part of the picture, I think. The aesthetics of NSAID are indeed important to Gamo people, who comment on the way in which an NSAID grove that is not growing well seems to suggest that the owner of the compound has abandoned his land and no longer cares. So there's an aesthetic and there's a moral aspect. If you don't look after your NSAID groves, that suggests that you've abandoned your land. And abandoning your land is a very serious thing in this part of Ethiopia. Equally, from the point of view of Gamo people, if a person had no NSAID, it would simply not make sense to build a house. One woman asked about why go to all the work of planting your NSAID behind your house if you could just have it out in your field. Simply said, what would be the point of building a house if you didn't plant NSAID behind it? In another saying, NSAID and the beauty of a homestead are explicitly connected to the beauty of a child whose skin has been made shiny with butter. Butter in Gamo is important to eat, but it's also important in the beautification and blessing of people. So the beauty of a child whose skin has been made shiny with butter, and this is the same as this. Whose house is that with the beautiful NSAID grove around it? And whose son is that with the butter on his face? We started with Malinowski and his observations on Trobriand Gardens, and here at the end we could come back, perhaps once more, to his work, because he captured so beautifully the way in which gardens are fundamental to understanding everyday Trobriand life, which resonates so well with our understanding of growing and living with NSAID among the Gamo. This is what he had to say. The gardens are in a way a work of art. Exactly as a native will take an artist's delight in constructing a canoe or a house, perfect in shape, decoration, and finish, and the whole community will glory in such an achievement, exactly thus will he go about laying out and developing his garden. Thank you.